Mina Harker's journal. 6 November. It was late in the afternoon when the professor and I took our way towards the east, whence I knew Jonathan was coming. We could hear the distant howling of wolves. They were far off, but the sound, even though coming muffled through the deadening snowfall, was full of terror. In a little while, the professor signalled to me. He had found a wonderful spot, a sort of natural hollow in a rock, with an entrance like a doorway between two boulders. Taking his field glasses from the case, he stood on the top of the rock and began to search the horizon. Suddenly, he called out, "Look, Madame Mina! Look! Look!" I sprang up and stood beside him on the rock. He handed me his glasses and pointed. The snow was now falling more heavily and swirled about fiercely, for a high wind was beginning to blow. However, there were times when there were pauses between snow flurries, and I could see a group of mounted men hurrying along. In the midst of them was a cart, a long, lighter wagon, which swept from side to side like a dog's tail wagging with each stern inequality of the road. Outlined against the snow as they were, I could see from the men's clothes that they were peasants or gypsies of some kind. On the cart was a great square chest. My heart leaped as I saw it, for I felt that the end was coming. The evening was now drawing close, and well I knew that at sunset the thing which was till then imprisoned there would take new freedom and could in any of many forms elude all pursuit.
"See,"
Van Helsing said,
"they come quickly. They are flogging the horses and galloping as hard as they can."
He paused and went on in a hollow voice,
"They are racing for the sunset. We may be too late. God's will be done. Look! Look! See the horsemen follow fast, coming up from the south. It must be Quincy and John."
Looking around, I saw on the north side of the coming party two other men, riding at breakneck speed. One of them I knew was Jonathan, and the other I took, of course, to be Arthur. They, too, were pursuing the party with the cart. When I told the professor, he shouted in glee like a schoolboy, and after looking intently till snowfall made sight impossible, he laid his Winchester rifle ready for use against the boulder at the opening of our shelter.
"They are all converging," he said. "When the time comes, we shall have the gypsies on all sides."
I got out my revolver ready to hand, for whilst we were speaking, the howling of wolves came louder and closer. The professor and I crouched down behind our rock and held our weapons ready. I could see that he was determined that they should not pass. One and all were quite unaware of our presence. All at once, two voices shouted out to halt. One was my Jonathan's, raised in a high key of passion. The other, Mr. Morris's strong, resolute tone of quiet command. The gypsies instinctively reined in, and at the instant, Arthur and Jonathan dashed up at one side, and Dr. Seward and Mr. Morris on the other. At the same moment, Dr. Van Helsing and I rose behind the rock and pointed our weapons at them. Seeing that they were surrounded, the men tightened their reins and drew up. The leader turned to them and gave a word, at which every man of the gypsy party drew what weapon he carried, knife or pistol, and held himself in readiness to attack. Issue was joined in an instant. All four men of our party threw themselves from their horses and dashed towards the cart. Nothing seemed to stop or even to hinder them. Neither the levelled weapons or the flashing knives of the gypsies in front or the howling of the wolves behind appeared to even attract their attention. Jonathan's impetuosity and the manifest singleness of his purpose seemed to overawe those in front of him. Instinctively, they cowered aside and let him pass. In an instant, he had jumped upon the cart and, with a strength which seemed incredible, raised the great box and flung it over the wheel to the ground. In the meantime, Mr. Morris had had to use force to pass through his side of the ring of gypsies. I saw their knives flash as he won a way through them, and they cut at him. He parried with his great bowie knife, and at first I thought that he too had come through in safety. But as he sprang beside Jonathan, who had by now jumped from the cart, I could see that with his left hand he was clutching at his side, and that the blood was spurting through his fingers. He did not delay, notwithstanding this, for as Jonathan, with desperate energy, attacked one end of the chest, attempting to prise off the lid with his great cookery knife, he attacked the other frantically with his bowie. Under the efforts of both men, the lid began to yield. The nails drew with a quick screeching sound, and the top of the box was thrown back. By this time, the gypsies, seeing themselves covered by the Winchesters, had given in and made no further resistance. The sun was almost down on the mountain tops, and the shadows of the whole group fell long upon the snow. I saw the Count lying within the box upon the earth, some of which the rood falling from the cart had scattered over him. He was deathly pale, just like a waxen image, and the red eyes glared with the horrible, vindictive look which I knew too well. As I looked, the eyes saw the sinking sun, and the look of hate in them turned to triumph. But on the instant came the sweep and flash of Jonathan's great knife. I shrieked as I saw it shear through the throat, whilst at the same moment Mr. Morris's bowie knife plunged into the heart. It was like a miracle. But before our very eyes, and almost in the drawing of a breath, the whole body crumbled into dust and passed from our sight. I shall be glad as long as I live that even in that moment of final dissolution, there was in the face a look of peace such as I never could have imagined might have rested there. The castle of Dracula now stood out against the red sky, and every stone of its broken battlements was articulated against the light of the setting sun. The gypsies, taking us as in some way the cause of the extraordinary disappearance of the dead man, turned without a word and rode away as if for their lives. The wolves followed in their wake, leaving us alone. Mr. Morris, who had sunk to the ground, leaned on his elbow, holding his hand pressed to his side. The blood still gushed through his fingers. I flew to him, for the holy circle did not now keep me back. So did the two doctors. Jonathan knelt behind him, and the wounded man laid back his head on his shoulder. With a sigh, he took, with a feeble effort, my hand in that of his own, which was unstained. He must have seen the anguish of my heart in my face, for he smiled at me and said, "I'm only too happy to have been of any service." "Oh, God!" he cried suddenly, struggling up to a sitting posture and pointing to me. "It was worth this to die. Look, look." The sun was now right down upon the mountain top, and the red gleams fell upon my face so that it was bathed in rosy light. With one impulse the men sank on their knees, and a deep and earnest amen broke from all as their eyes followed the pointing of his finger as the dying man spoke. Now God be thanked that all has not been in vain. See, the snow is not more stainless than her forehead. Curse, the curse has passed away. And to our bitter grief, with a smile and in silence, he died, a gallant gentleman. Note by Jonathan Harker. 7 years ago, we all went through the flames, and the happiness of some of us since then is, we think, well worth the pain we endured. It is an added joy to Mina and to me that our boy's birthday is the same day as that on which Quincy Morris died. His mother holds, I know, the secret belief that some of our brave friend's spirit has passed into the child. We call him Quincy. Sometimes at home, we talk of the old time, which we can all look back on without despair. For Arthur Homewood and Dr. Seward are both happily married. We could hardly ask anyone, even did we wish to accept proofs of so wild a story. Van Helsing summed it all up, as he said, with our boy on his knee, "We want no proofs. We ask none to believe us. This boy will some day know what a brave and gallant woman his mother is. Already he knows her sweetness and loving care. Later on, he will understand how some men so loved her that they did dare much for her sake."